Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
Happy New Year, everybody. We hope your 2025 is off to a great start. This is obviously our first episode of the new year, and it is time for us to shift our focus a little bit from NCAA women's volleyball to Love, PVF, big happenings in other pro leagues around the world, and NCAA men's volleyball. So it was a very exciting week this week as Love kicked off its inaugural season. PVF began their second season. The transfer portal has been popping still, and the NCAA men's preseason is underway. So we have a lot of fun stuff to discuss today. So let's get started. Starting out our traditional weekly highlight segment with transfer portal updates this week. A lot has happened.
We also had quite a few comments and opinions on our last episode when we dove into the transfer portal, and some of them I'd like to address and discuss a little bit more.
Yes. So what were they, Adam?
So one of the common themes that we didn't discuss was about money being a big factor for athletes transferring. And totally correct. Athletes are leaving for really good sums of money. You know, it's something that we didn't want to address primarily because we didn't have any concrete information. Quite frankly, it's not always on the top of our mind because that wasn't our college experience. In the meantime, we have done a little digging. It's a very accurate statement. There are very large sums of money being thrown around to athletes who have to make decisions about staying with their team or securing their financial future. And it is definitely playing a role in decisions. And yeah, we just wanted to acknowledge that. And there were a lot of really good points around that.
So thanks to all of you who shared that with us. Again, yeah, we missed that. So thanks for bringing it up. It's a valid point. So that kind of leads into our first transfer. Tori Stafford is heading to Texas. I want to say like 2 minutes after it was posted that she was entering the portal, I got tagged in a message on Instagram with somebody being like, look at this. And I have to admit, I was unwell. Like, this rattled me for a couple days, you guys. I was not okay with this.
I mean, I agree. And this was one of the ones there were rumored big money around this deal. You know, initially there were thoughts around Babcock going to play pro and the coach leaving, none of which appears to be true. And, you know, Tori Stafford came out and said, I want to be close to home. I'm feeling a little homesick. You know, at this point, and I get it's not going to be a popular decision with her teammates. If you're going to do it and you're going to chase the payday, which is totally her right, own up to it and do it.
Just like, let's call it what it is. Homesick, you're not going home, okay? So I was rattled when she announced it, and I was even more rattled, but not shocked at all when it was Texas. Because if you remember last episode, I was like, so surprised that Texas hadn't picked up more players. And I was like, just wait. They wait for the blue chip athletes to enter the portal and they snag them. Shocker. Tori Stafford it is, everybody. Rumor has it, Texas didn't even give her the highest offer. There were schools that gave her higher offers than Texas, but Texas is the choice. So great pickup for Texas. Absolutely. After losing Skinner. So that breaks my heart. I can't believe it. I can't think about it. That one hurt me.
They win the transfer portal this year, for sure. One of the other things that came up in the comments around transfer portal was athletes taking a little bit of ownership back about their careers. And my personal opinion about this is that is true, and the athletes should have the ability to make their decisions. I think some of the comments that we talked about was lamenting the fact that college sports has become professional and a business at that point. That's the reality of it. And when we talk about loyalty and lessons and building as a team, those to me were the skills that you learned as a transition athlete from high school to professional. And it wasn't about, our comments weren't about disempowering the athletes or them having no control over what they want. It's both of us had very positive experiences in college, dealing with hard situations, succeeding through tough lessons and tough situations and coming out on the other side. Now, that's not always everybody's experience, and people should never stay in bad situations, but we both do lament the loss of that pure athletic pursuit because it really is very professional at this point.
But we also were told about Avery Carlson's situation in Texas, which we did appreciate that info as well. Apparently, when she won the starting spot, she was getting hate messages from Texas fans, even when the team was winning. So in that scenario, I know I was critical of her now entering her third program, but that is one of the situations we talked about where it's like, okay, yes, this is like making you mentally unwell. Like, it is fair. But speaking of her, she is heading to SMU. So SMU has now picked up 6 portal athletes, and we already know my feeling about that. Lourdes Meyer from Purdue has committed to Minnesota, and Flor Marie Heredia Colon from Miami is heading to Florida, which good pickup for them. I think a good compliment to Kennedy Martin. And another fun fact that I was looking at is Arizona State has now picked up 5 players from the portal, but they only lost 1. So they are another program that is like consistently poaching from the portal year after year. So
I'm curious to see if more of their players enter the portal in the second phase now that they've brought so many players in. It'll be interesting to see how that dynamic works out moving into the spring season. So there was a lot of talk about what was going to happen in the women's program now that Karch had moved over to the men's side, and we have an answer. Eric Sullivan was named the USA national team women's head coach. He's been an associate at Texas for the last 14 years. He was selected because of his reputation as a master of defensive systems, his ability to develop top-tier talent, and the experience in high-pressure environments. He was a 2-time Olympian as a player in 2000 and 2004 and a team leader for the USA men's team at the last 3 Olympics. So I think that's a really good hire. You want to keep somebody who has that experience, who's been in the system. I do believe that Dan Fisher was in the conversation, but given his international experience and where he's been, I think that that's a smart choice.
I like that hire, actually. I think it's a great choice. He's been a part of the system since his days as an athlete. And I mean, everything that was highlighted on the website as to why he was selected, you can't disagree with it. But I also think like the women's team has like such a foundation of excellence, and they've really worked on developing that solid culture, especially with Karch. And so I think like that's a perfect transition, because I think that he will embody those values that the team has.
I also think, given that the Olympics are in LA in 2028, both programs have been relatively successful. Pressure is going to be high. I think bringing somebody in who hasn't done the cycles or been a part of that, that's a lot of pressure and probably a little bit too much of an unknown for USA Volleyball going into that highly touted Olympics.
Oh, absolutely. And the international game and the planning, the strategy, all of that, like it is 100% different than the college game where there's such an emphasis put on recruiting and things like that. So I'm excited about that pick. I think it's great.
Yeah, I was a little shocked. I didn't pay close attention to it, but looking at it from the lens now, I think it's a really good hire.
We also had the Love debut and the beginning of PVF season 2 this week. So in the first match in Love Pro history, Salt Lake City defeated Atlanta 3-1. This game was actually played at the Gateway Center Arena, which is the same venue used by the Atlanta Dream of the WNBA. So for basketball games, it typically it has a capacity of 3,500 people, and it was posted that the Love attendance was around 3,300. So
yeah, pretty close to selling out the venue. Good crowd.
Pretty good for that venue. In the Weekend with Love series, Houston beat Austin 3-2 in a reverse sweep. Austin beat Madison 3-0, and Omaha beat Houston 3-0.
We also had the PVF season openers. Orlando beat San Diego 3-0. Vegas beat Grand Rapids 3-2 at home. And then Omaha did the same thing to Atlanta.
Our final highlight of the week is NCAA men's volleyball. So the AVCA preseason poll came out December 30th, and it had UCLA at number one, Long Beach State at two, UC Irvine was three, Hawaii at four, and Ball State was five. The next poll is coming out January 13th. Which is obviously different than the women's poll because there's way fewer teams. But the preseason began at the very beginning of January, and this week in particular, there were a couple interesting matches that happened. Number 12, Loyola Chicago, beat number 8, Penn State, 3-1. And number 5, Ball State, handled number 13, Stanford, 3-0 on Friday. So we're seeing teams play like back-to-backs and things like that. So it's really interesting how they're all mixing it up. But I personally thought that those two matches were particularly interesting. So much volleyball to be played. So much transfer portal drama as always. So it's a spicy start to 2025. Last episode, we kind of did a Love PVF preview. And we're asking a lot of questions. And we got those questions answered. And now, having watched some matches, we also have some answers, but I wanted to give a huge shout out to one of our listeners named Rudy, who gave us an in-depth rundown of both leagues. The info was outstanding. We're going to do a little comparison of Love and PVF to give like the overview of each league.
And I'm assuming that we will continue to learn about each league as we watch a little bit more and go through. So as we pick up more tidbits of information, we'll also share that with you. But this is what we have so far.
Some questions have been thrown around as to why the certain locations were selected. I do know for Love, they picked the cities they did because they were the biggest youth volleyball and club volleyball markets in the U.S., so it might be confusing why Austin and Houston each have a team. Both of those cities have massive club volleyball presences, and so they selected the cities based on that. For the PVF, I don't think it was as deliberate. I obviously think they picked cities based on where there's a huge volleyball following, but I don't think it was as specific as Love was in their market research. So as far as the scheduling goes, PVF has 8 teams. Each team plays each of the other teams 4 times, 2 times at home, 2 times away. That's a total of 112 regular season matches. And then there's a 4-team single elimination playoff. So each team will play 14 home matches, and most matches last season ended up drawing like 4,000 to 6,000 people by the end of the season. Love, however, has 6 teams, and each week there's one head-to-head match, and then the Weekend with Love series featuring 3 matches between the 4 other teams. If it sounds confusing, it's because it is. So this format rotates among each city, and I know we touched on this last episode, but just to reiterate, that is a total of 48 regular season matches, and each team will play 6 home matches. So there's also a mid-season tournament in February and a playoff tournament at the end of the season. I'm not a huge fan of the Love format. I prefer the traditional format that we see with PVF, and typically overseas you'll see teams play 1 match a week. The PVF format's a little different because a couple teams are playing 2 matches in a weekend, because obviously the season timeline is much, much shorter than you see in Europe. But I'm not a huge fan of the Love system, particularly when you're bringing 4 teams to a place and a couple of those teams are only playing 1 match. It's like, I don't know. Not to mention the limited number of home matches, but That is the difference between the schedule.
That decision seemed really interesting to me because I think you're going to have people struggle to identify with their home team because they're not playing there very often. And we'll talk about the branding later on, but I'm really curious to see how that pans out. Let's talk about the look and design of both of those. So now we've watched a couple matches of each. We've seen the presentation. PVF has a very individual team design. You get a feeling that the team is created unto itself. They are trying to win and, you know, nothing else matters. They're playing in a league. It's a very kind of NFL, NBA, baseball feel to it. They talk about the general managers. They're talking about the draft. They're talking about trading players. It feels very professional sport.
Well, they all have completely unique uniforms. They have their own unique team name, a really cool logo. Like, everything is very specific to each team. And I like that a lot.
It allows you to connect with a team or a coach or a player on a team and have some affinity to that group of athletes. And I think that that's really important and one of the keys in why people watch sport. If we look at Love, there's not really any individuals that are being prioritized. And I mean that both as athletes, other than the founding athletes, but the teams as well. Everything that we've seen so far in the pro section is about the Love brand. They all have very similar uniforms. All of their logos represent the city they play for, but they're all kind of the same. It's really hard when you watch to actually tell the teams apart on TV, and the players' names on the jerseys are really small and below the hair. It's really hard to kind of get into a team, and it almost felt watching this week like it was a scrimmage or a friendly match. And that's not to take away from the level or how it happened. It just, that was kind of the atmosphere that I got watching it on TV.
Yeah, I don't like that the uniforms are the exact same. The only thing that changes is like an accent color and maybe a sponsor name on the front. But like, even the court is completely Love branded and the big Love brand sponsors. Whereas you watch the PVF and it's like the team's sponsors are all over the court. So yeah. And the small names on the jersey. Like, no, I didn't like that.
Yeah, agree. It was very, and again, on the men, sometimes you can get away with that because the hair's not in the way. Almost every woman's ponytail blocked their name. So if you didn't know who the player was, it was very hard to figure out who they were.
And finally, let's compare the general brand. Love, it is very clear, is all about the pathway from club to college to pro and being able to keep that accessible to girls all over the country for the entirety of their career so that they always have a place to play. PVF seems more autonomous and more of a standalone league. You don't really see as much of the crossover to the club or youth. Obviously, they do community engagement, but it's not as at the forefront or like what the mission is like it is for Love. I honestly think Love is winning in the TV department.
I mean, without seeing the numbers, I would agree with you.
And it's just like way easier to find like ESPN, ESPN Plus, versus like Fox Sports 2 or like YouTube.
One match on Volleyball World TV.
Yeah. So I liked the accessibility of the Love games. The Love, as I mentioned earlier, the Love sponsors seem to be league and brand wide instead of specific to the individual teams.
So one of the interesting things watching the two separate leagues this week is Love was all about their mission as a league and as a brand. Every time something happened on the court or there was a play, it came back to a founding athlete or the athletes playing at home or, you know, how many kids there have in the stands and the athletes connecting with them, all of which is great. I actually personally love the Love mission. I think it's a very worthy approach to sport and a holistic view. I'm all for it. When I'm watching the pros play, I personally want to watch the volleyball. I want to hear the analysis of what's going on. I want to hear about the decisions, about the match I'm watching. And for me, that was lacking in the broadcast. And I understand it's week one. I understand they're bringing their brand to the world. I get that. I hope that it becomes less as they continue playing and that their professional broadcasts lean more into the volleyball and less into the mission and the background of the company.
I agree. I mean, it's clear also that Love is trying to position itself among the top leagues in the world. Like the number of times we heard like, oh, the top players in the world are playing here. It's like, well, there are a couple, but like, let's be honest. But they kept pushing that narrative too about how like the best players are playing here. So I think that is definitely their long-term goal.
Which is totally fair.
But you don't get that messaging at all from PVF. It was strictly about just the volleyball.
Correct.
Overall, from what we've seen so far, the Love level of play is much higher. For me, PVF seemed like an extension of college volleyball. They delivered a great product. It was entertaining to watch. I enjoyed hearing the analysis that was missing from the Love broadcasts, but you cannot compare the level.
I mean, and I think for me, one of the biggest pieces of that was across the board, Love seems to have experienced international setters, which I think makes a really big difference. They're able to push the pace. We'll talk about this a little more in the game analysis, but I think getting those top end setters along with really credible international coaches is going to help continue to push that level. And you saw that in the first week of competition.
And I mean, the final thing to touch on here that Love is very transparent about is how they are providing health insurance and maternity leave to their athletes, which honestly, in
amazing
professional volleyball around the world, maternity leave is not a thing. It's just like, you're having a kid, good luck. Hopefully you can come back. The health insurance, like clubs do purchase health insurance for their athletes when they're overseas. Obviously the American system is different than the systems we see around the world, but the Love mission is very focused on female empowerment and giving women the choice and the opportunity to pursue whatever they want. And I think that that is a very noble mission, especially because it's been so lacking for so long. So that's really cool.
And I want to end this section by saying I am wholeheartedly on board with the Love mission and the end goal of what they're doing. I think it's amazing. I hope that once they kind of get that messaging out there, that we transition into focusing on the volleyball, because it could be very, very good in the future and it could be its own standalone product.
All right, we are going to get into our feature matches of the week. The first feature match is Love Houston versus Austin. What are your initial takeaways? Not even takeaways, but just like thoughts.
I really enjoyed watching the game. I thought that both Mrzyk and Skinner were very good, which was really good to see. We kind of talked about how Mrzyk's game would transition to a pro level, and we talked about her ability to find the block and how we thought that that would be a skill that would come in handy when she started playing pro. And let me tell you, she's still finding fingernails.
And
it was impressive to watch, and I really enjoyed the match overall. It was very close. It was very competitive. Yeah, very positive. I enjoyed it.
I was unsure of how Jess Mrzyk would transition to a higher level of play. And based on what I saw in that match, I shouldn't have doubted her. Obviously, it's the very beginning of her career. I don't know what will happen. But for where she's at right now, I was very impressed. You know, in the NCAA season, we talked about how she tends to start a little slow. That was the case this match as well, ladies and gentlemen. She got blocked several times early, got taken out in set one, but re-entered the match and honestly was their best player, I thought. Very consistent, great blocking, picked up some great balls on defense, found the fingertips. Like, we were like, okay, she's very good at this.
Yeah, I mean, I think she won player of the game, and I think it was well-deserved. She was very good, and she didn't miss a beat. I was also going to say, you have to remember that these college players who came in got probably 2 weeks of training with their teams, with their setters, And so for her to come in and to find that offensive rhythm that quickly in the match was kudos. Kudos to both of them. Skinner was very good as well.
I was pretty confident that Skinner would transition well to a higher level of play. I was surprised that they switched her to the opposite.
What do you think of that move?
Oh, I think it's a strictly ball handling decision. I think the left sides that they have in the two that they chose to start in Jannari and Hawk, I think they are much better passers than Skinner. So I personally think it was a ball handling decision and like, let's just have Maddie score and just focus on scoring points. I think it was a good move. I honestly was surprised that Hawk was starting for them. I wasn't shocked to see Jannari. She's got a ton of experience. She's an outstanding player. The Hawk decision, I was a little surprised about. I don't know who I expected to play instead of her. Maybe Eggleston. But again, from a passing perspective, it was a good choice.
Well, we ended up with a pretty much all Texas roster in the fifth set. So that was kind of fun to see, and I think a cool storyline for Love. Looking at the match overall, it seemed to be a game of giving up leads.
Oh my goodness. Literally every set.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So the first two sets, Houston was up big after 20, and Austin came back to win both of those. And I thought Austin had a massive lead in the third set that they were going to sweep in three, but the team who was winning late in the match did not win the sets. Austin also gave up an 11-6 lead in the fifth set, which is mind-blowing.
It was like 10-4 at one point.
Yeah.
It was insane. Literally every single set, whoever had a big lead lost the set.
A question I had for you was, who do you think won the setting battle?
I think overall, Micah Hancock won the setting battle. I think she delivered some good balls. I think she ran a solid offense. My critique of her is that I don't think she ran the middle enough,
correct,
particularly Rafaela Folie. I think Folie is an experienced middle. She's a great attacker. And Hancock was not running the middle at all. She basically was only setting Mrzek and Jordan Thompson. She was also, when it got to crunch time, particularly in sets one and two, when Houston had the lead, she made some terrible sets, like almost unhittable. But then on the same side, I think the setting in general was a little inconsistent. I just think Micah Hancock was, we saw her inconsistency near the end of sets.
Yeah, she was really good up until 20. And then I agree, some of the execution seemed to drop off. That was also exacerbated by the fact that Thompson could not score at the end of sets. I believe she went 0-7 on set points when she was attacking. A lot of tips, she got blocked. It was crazy to see because other than that, she was very good.
So many tips and so many sets over. And I will say, like, when they found themselves in that position, she was stuck on the left side, which she's not a left side attacker, but you'd think she'd find a way, you know? And I was just stunned at how she was not able to put the ball down in crunch time.
Yeah, it was, like you said, her efficiency on the left side was a stark difference from her efficiency on the right side. And they always got stuck in that rotation one late. And it'll be interesting to see how they address that issue moving forward because it was a problem.
I did like when they did the double sub. The Finnish setter ran the middle a lot. And the announcers were very critical of running the middle because they're like, you've got a Ogbogbu up there. Like, why do you keep setting? She's such a good blocker. And it's like, sometimes it's not even about scoring the point. It's about creating some confusion or making them think a little bit longer so that the outside hitters don't have a wall in front of them. And I really appreciated how the Finnish setter came in and ran the middle consistently whenever she had that chance. I do think Hancock saved them at the end of set four and set five with her serving. Wowee. That lefty 5-5 serve is a killer. If you're a lefty out there, and you want to spin serve, even if you've got a, it is such a messed up angle for the passers. It just visually is so strange, and the ball spins in a different way than they expect. Like, use that.
Well, it's interesting you talk about running the middle, because in sets 1 and 2, Austin outblocked Houston 14-6 in those first two sets. And then by the end of the match, it was much more even. Now, we can talk about players starting slow. We can talk about whatever you want. But at the end of the day, running that middle does open up seams, both on the pins and coming out of the back row. And I think that that was at least a large portion of why the hitters were more successful after that.
I will say Austin's blocking was outstanding.
Outstanding.
Particularly, I was so impressed by Ogbogbu's blocking. I know she got best blocker at the Olympics, you guys. I know that. But, like, wow. It was wonderful.
Austin controlled the net from a block standpoint, finishing the match with 22 blocks to Houston's 15. But Houston dug better, 80 digs to 58. They also had 7 aces to Austin's 5, and they were in system more of the time. So it was an interesting trade-off, but Houston won a lot of the categories outside of the blocking. They also managed to close the gap in sets 3, 4, and 5.
You know, Austin was coming after Mrzek, and I think she handled it very well. I think, you know, down the stretch, Hawk for Austin. Hawk was replaced by Eggleston, and Micah Hancock was going after her or going after seams and got a few aces that way.
She was clutch when she needed to be clutch from the service line. I don't think they win that match without her doing that. It was impressive.
I did think that Austin had a bit of a lack of connection with their middles. I know we talked about setter inconsistency, but and you could really see it from the middle. A lot of them were underset, like a little low. The slides were not really working. But so we did see a sub, Sage, I'm going to butcher her last name. You know who I mean. Came in for Carly Lloyd late in the match. And I think her connection with the hitters was better. Obviously, it was basically like her college team, so she set them all before. But things seemed to be running a little more smoothly then. But yeah, my criticism overall for both sides was that they didn't run the middle enough.
Well, and I think probably to be expected, given the teams are just coming together. It's the first match of the league. You know, it's going to take a little bit of time to gel. So I think I agree with you. It didn't happen enough. I'm curious to see which team can establish that and utilize those players as we get a little more training and a little further into the season.
And, like, I understand that this is really early in the season. Like, they are working through their finding their system, finding their rhythm. There are growing pains. The players who are playing in college just joined a couple weeks ago. Like, I understand that it's not as polished as it will be a month from now. But just from where it was right now, those were my observations. I did appreciate, too, how in all of the love matches we watched, the coaches were experimenting with lineups, and there you saw a lot of changes happening. You saw players coming in and staying for, you know, the rest of the match or the rest of a set. And so you could just see the coaches experimenting, trying to see what's working, what's not working. And you don't, as we've talked about in the past, you don't often see that in the college game because there are so many other things at play. So I thought that that was really neat. I did appreciate how often Austin ran the back row. They ran it predominantly with Skinner, and they were moving her around, which I thought was really nice, out of the pipe and on the right. Houston was running Jordan Thompson out of the back row, but predominantly from the right. And then they didn't really use Mrzek much in the back row. They didn't really use it aside from Jordan Thompson. So I did appreciate that addition. And sometimes, you know, you had Austin running two players out of the back row, which when they're in system and if they can keep that going, they're going to be tough to stop.
I agree. I really liked the back row option that they had going, especially with two players. And you saw Skinner was very effective both from the front and the back. And I thought that that connection was really good. You had mentioned to me as we were talking that Carly Lloyd had not played in a little bit. She had been on the beach. She was transitioning. She wasn't sure what she was going to do. So I'm expecting to see her connection with her teammates improve as we go and we see the season progress.
Overall, I thought that it was a great match. Honestly, the level of this particular love match was higher than I expected.
Agreed.
It was a lot of fun. The teams, you can see them, you know, they're starting to gel. The coaches are invested. You can tell that they are very passionate. So overall, I think this match was a ton of fun to watch. And I'm really excited to see how these teams and these individual players develop as the season goes on. And interestingly, Mrzyk, Skinner, and Franklin, Sarah Franklin, playing in Madison, are the only three players of the Love Six that saw any time. So good for them. Our second feature match of the week is PVF Atlanta Vibe versus Omaha Supernovas. Hit me with your thoughts.
It was fun to watch. I thought the presentation was great. The fans in the stadium were fantastic. I was really engaged the whole match. And in fairness, I believe we watched the first match of Love, which was Atlanta and Salt Lake City. And there were a few production issues with that one. And that was our first taste of Love. And then we watched this one. And the comparison between those two, in my opinion, was quite stark.
Oh, yeah.
It was a lot of fun to watch this match. Like you said, the level was not, it seemed more along the lines of the college game. And specifically, in my opinion, the set speed and location was not as fast. And given we watched Jordan Poulter in that first match, who runs a super fast offense. So there were some stark differences from a production standpoint and then from a volleyball standpoint in that regard. But an entertainment value in that match was very high. Beeson played really well at the beginning and the end of the match. It was good to see her at least start well, given how her
first
college
season ended.
First
2 points of the game, maybe.
And then she scored 6 at the end, which was...
Like, literally was unconscious at the end of the 5th set. And I'm like, did you just take a 3.5 set break? Like, what is going on right now?
But she looked like she was having fun.
She didn't look quite so stressed or high strung as we saw her look at the end of the college season.
And the other thing I appreciated about the PVF was that team environment. They were invested. They were competing. They were coming together. It felt like pro sports.
That was the biggest. No, there were a lot of positives for me, but that is the thing that made me smile the most was these women were so invested. They were intense. They really, really looked like a team. They had that connection. I talk about it all the time, like the eye contact, the, you know, talking to each other between play. Like, it was cool to see that, like, camaraderie, especially with so many young new players that had joined the rosters. Yeah, it was incredible to see how many fans were there. You know, the Supernovas, people are in like all these sparkly clothes. I thought it was so cool. The amount of merch that I saw the fans in the crowd wearing, I'm like, this feels like a pro sport. I didn't necessarily get that level of engagement feeling or that level of intensity from the love matches. The level was higher, but it was just exciting to watch. And coming off of the NCAA season, it was like a really cool transition.
Well, we talked about there being 3,300 people at the love match, and the match we watched in Omaha had close to 10,000 people.
Over 13,000.
Was it over 13,000? Yes. So the stadium was packed. The atmosphere was loud, and you could really hear everything that was going on, which I really appreciated.
So at the start of the match, the only rookie on the court, period, was Merritt Beeson. And then as the game progressed, we started to see more rookies being given opportunities. On the Atlanta side, unfortunately, Shelly Fanning, the middle blocker, went down early in the second set with an ankle injury. So Corey Lewis, the rookie from Florida State, came in to replace her. So that's like an unfortunate situation, but I think she came in and did a great job. We saw Lindsey Krause come in and serve a couple times. We saw Batenhorst come in.
Batenhorst played well.
She did very well. I was very impressed with her. So it was cool to see the rookies start to be integrated. Obviously, like we said with Love, they joined their programs very late. So we might see more integration as the season progresses and they can like work into the system a bit more. But it was cool.
Who were your MVPs from each team in this match?
For Omaha, I really liked Nunaviller. I think she brought intensity. She brought energy. She is a great ball control player. She had the hustle, the fight. She scored well. And then, especially down the stretch, she was unconscious. I think she hit over 800 in set five.
Yeah, she was 228 on the match with 22 kills and 57 attempts. So she definitely led the team in that regard.
So she was my MVP. What about you?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I thought Nunaviller was probably the best player in the match. She was very standout, very noticeable on the court. She moved the ball around, scored in different ways. She was impressive to watch.
I also really liked, if we're comparing setters, which we like to do, I really liked Valentine Anderson, the setter for Omaha as well. I think her serving choices were excellent. The way that she had that zone four serve dialed in, like she caused a lot of problems for Atlanta with that. I think her decision making was good. Her defense, she picked up some incredible balls. Her leadership, like she's been playing pro for 16 years.
She brought a calmness and a competitive spirit to that team, and she was the leader.
I honestly didn't love the setter for Atlanta.
There were too many sets over. So for me, I don't think she did a bad job, but she wasn't as good. And it still felt very college-esque to me. Setting balls over, trying to catch teams, score cheap points.
She kept doing it. And he doesn't mean set over like she's setting a hitter and setting over the net. It's the side set.
The dump.
The dump. We don't love that.
Well, I mean, you have to change with how the game changes. You, in general, have higher IQ players at the professional level. They've seen more. They read the game better. Their eye works are better. Their progressions are better. They play defense as a team. You need to be focused on putting your hitters in good positions, running an offense. And obviously she had a plan, but you couldn't tell who she was trying to isolate in different rotations, who she was trying to get going. It was, hey, I'm going to set this player. So it wasn't necessarily about her execution, but I think her decision-making was not what I would want to see at a professional level.
We mentioned Beeson not being very effective in the middle of the match, and I do think that a large part of that was Omaha made an adjustment with their block defense. So Beeson, particularly out of the back row, hits a pretty neutral angle, you know, corner, basically zone six to zone one-ish. And she was scoring pretty effectively on that. And to Omaha's credit, after set one, they moved their block in. They left a panel of line for their libero, and they blocked her a lot. And so I think, you know, we saw some of those adjustments happening on the Omaha side. I think Horde blocked very well. Like, she in particular made that adjustment, but Beeson didn't change back. She didn't make the counter adjustment to that. Again, her first pro match, but like somebody needs to tell her what's going on if she can't, you know, get there herself.
And in fairness, she scored very effectively in the fifth set. So there was a little bit of movement or elevated play at that point. I think she has the physical tools to do well in this league. And I'm curious to see what her progression looks like with this team in this year under a new system.
We heard Atlanta was the preseason number one, so they were picked to win it all. Honestly, their libero, Morgan Hentz, I think, very good. She did a great job.
Atlanta passed very well. They were always in system. They had 53% positive touches, 31% perfect passes compared to Omaha's 39% positive touches and 21% perfect. And this was actually something I wanted to talk about. Atlanta ran the middle incredibly well. Vecchini had the second most points on the team at 15, hitting 435 on 23 attempts with four blocks. Anytime, in my opinion, that you can have a middle as one of your team's main point scorers, that's a great sign. It's going to open up the rest of your team. If Atlanta can continue to pass that well, I think they're going to be a good team. Now, I think they struggle a little bit to have terminal hitters, and so they're going to have to sort that out. Are they going to be a team that is in system all the time and that's what other teams find challenging? They always have three or four hitting options. Or are they going to have somebody who can get them out of trouble? I'm curious to see which direction the team goes and what their identity is going to become.
Leah Edmond, who was the player of the year for PVF last year, she didn't do much.
She didn't have a good match.
So I think, you know, she's going to really have to step up and score a lot more points for Atlanta if they're going to be successful. As you were saying, like, yes, great sign if your middle is your one of your top scorers, because that is like showing the health of your serve receive. So if your middle is scoring that much, your serve receive is on point, which, as Adam said, the stats showed it was. But yeah, Edmond was disappointing to me.
I mean, so she hit 065 on the match with 46 attempts and 11 kills. I have to imagine if she was player of the year, that match was an anomaly.
Yeah, fair.
So that'll be something that'll be interesting to keep an eye on. I'm curious how good she normally is and how consistently she'll be able to score points for them.
At the end of that match, though, Omaha just seemed better to me.
One of the things that I think Atlanta will be spending a lot of time doing this week is their tip defense.
Holy moly.
There was not a lot of tips coming up
like
on that
zero.
Side. Yeah. And again, you know, we're talking about new team, new system, new season, you know, all of that. But that was a glaring issue to me. And we'll see if they can get their responsibilities together quickly and understand who's taken what balls. But that to me was a glaring issue watching that match. Overall, it was a really positive experience. I really enjoyed watching the game, which I think is a huge win. You know, obviously professional sports is about winning, but at the end of the day, it's also an entertainment product. And while, you know, we discussed the level maybe not being the same, the product was very entertaining, and we will only see those teams get better as the year goes on, as they have a chance to gel and push towards, you know, their final. As you said, we play 114 matches as a league, so we're going to see a lot of volleyball, and I really enjoyed watching that match.
So I'm going to call this section hot take / listener comments, because it's going to be a mashup of both.
So I don't know if I'm in the wrong on this or I have an unpopular opinion, but it happened in both leagues where we watched, and the commentators were talking about, you know, the athletes smiling and being good people and a whole bunch of things around.
I love watching her play. She always has a smile on her face.
And, you know, maybe this is just a personal preference.
This is a both of us hot take, FYI, everybody.
So, you know, feel free to tell me I'm wrong and to disagree with me, but that's not what sport's about. That you can be a great person, and that's great, but your ability to smile on the court and do things has no effect on the outcome of your play. I don't really think it needs to be highlighted as much as it is in women's sport. You never hear that in men's sport.
Oh, never. Just think of how ridiculous it would sound if commentators were saying that about men. I can't even picture it. So like, why do we have to talk about it for women? Why do we have to talk about, like, she looks so happy to be there? I understand good vibes are part of being on the court, but like,
but talk about it in terms of leadership. Talk about it in terms of the qualities that it brings to the team and allows you to participate. And I understand that there's a different dynamic on women's teams and men's teams. I think that we can agree that that is a thing. And it just, it's communicated in a way that, not that it lessens female sports, but it's just a difference. And I think we should be focusing on the sport, the athletes in and of themselves. Just my opinion, having listened to a couple of the matches.
At the end of the day, I think whether you like a player or not, you can choose to like or dislike whatever athletes you want, but it should come down to, especially on a broadcast that is about the game, it should be about the player's skill and things like that, and not so much about if the player is likable or looks like they're having a good time. Like, it just lessens the women's abilities, in my opinion.
So we had another tough question on the YouTube channel, and I think it was a fair question given, you know, what we said about this topic. And several people asked us, you know, why we didn't go into the San Jose State transgendered issue in more detail other than highlighting it. For me, my experience in talking about this situation is that people have a very hard time separating the social and political stance on this from the sport context.
Or the science.
And the science.
Because I think the sport and the science discussion are very tightly intertwined.
We love doing this podcast because we love the sport of volleyball. And what we don't want to happen is for this to become, hey, they said this, we're not going to listen to the podcast, or we have different views, or, you know, at the end of the day, we want to bring you volleyball and what's happening. And even if our social views and our sport views are different, my experience has been that it's very hard to have a rational conversation about this. And we want to keep this about the volleyball and about what's happening. So I appreciate the question. We're always up to have a debate and a good argument, if you will, with people about what we see and what we hear and what we talk about. But this particular issue is one where I don't think that discord would be A, kept civil, productive. And B, productive. So thank you for the question. You know, we'll keep our eye on it and we'll keep everybody up to date with what's going on. But that's probably as far as we'll go in that regard.
All right, looking forward, lots of volleyball happening this week. So if you're into NCAA men's volleyball, the matches that we suggest watching are number 5 Ball State is playing number 6 BYU on both Thursday and Friday, so that could be very exciting. And on Saturday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time, number 2 Long Beach State is playing number 14 Lewis. And at 10:30 p.m. Eastern that same evening, Saturday, number 1 UCLA is playing number 8 Penn State.
We also have the Love head-to-head match on Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern. We have Austin playing Atlanta. And the weekend matches are happening in Madison this week. For PVF, on Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern, Vegas is hosting Omaha. And on Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern, Atlanta is hosting Grand Rapids. So there's lots of volleyball to watch this week.
Those are our personal picks of what to watch, but we know you'll do you. And let us know what you end up watching and what you think. That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.